but dressed in bad taste, I thought. Purple dress, green hat, and yellow gloves. Little Nap is a handsome boy who sits chatting to his tutor and kissed his hand to the people as he passes in his four-horse barouche with postilions in red satin jackets and a mounted guard before and behind. We often walk in the Tuileries Gardens, for they are lovely, though the antique Luxembourg Gardens suit me better. Père Lachaise is very curious, for many of the tombs are like small rooms, and looking in, one sees a table with images or pictures of the dead, and chairs for the mourners to sit in when they come to lament. That is so Frenchy. Our rooms are on the Rue de Rivoli, and sitting on the balcony, we look up and down the long, brilliant street. It is so pleasant that we spend our evenings talking there when too tired with our day's work to go out. Fred is very entertaining and is altogether the most agreeable young man I ever knew, except Laurie, whose manners are more charming. I wish Fred was dark, for I don't fancy light men. However, the Vaughns are very rich and come of an excellent family, so I won't find fault with their yellow hair, as my own is yellower. Next week we are off to Germany and Switzerland, and as we shall travel fast, I shall only be able to give you hasty letters. I keep my diary and try to remember correctly and describe clearly all that I see and admire, as Father advised. It is good practice for me, and with my sketchbook will give you a better idea of my tour than these scribbles. Adieu, I embrace you tenderly. Votre ami. Heidelberg. My dear Mama, having a quiet hour before we leave for Bern, I'll try to tell you what has happened, for some of it is very important, as you will see. The sail up the Rhine was perfect, and I just sat and enjoyed it with all my might. Get Father's old guidebooks and read about it. I haven't words beautiful enough to describe it. At Koblenz we had a lovely time, for some students from Bonn, with whom Fred got acquainted on the boat, gave us a serenade. It was a moonlight night, and about 1 o'clock, Flo and I were wakened by the most delicious music under our windows. We flew up and hid behind the curtains, but sly peeps showed us Fred and the students singing away down below. It was the most romantic thing I ever saw. The river, the bridge of boats, the great fortress opposite, moonlight everywhere, and music fit to melt a heart of stone. When they were done, we threw down some flowers and saw them scramble for them, kiss their hands to the invisible ladies, and go laughing away to smoke and drink beer, I suppose. Next morning, Fred showed me one of the crumpled flowers in his vest pocket and looked very sentimental. I laughed at him and said I didn't throw it, but Flo, which seemed to disgust him, for he tossed it out of the window and turned sensible again. I'm afraid I'm going to have trouble with that boy. It begins to look like it. The baths at Nassau were very gay, so was Baden-Baden, where Fred lost some money, and I scolded him. He needs someone to look after him when Frank is not with him. Kate said once she hoped he'd marry soon, and I quite agree with her that it would be well for him. Frankfurt was delightful. I saw Goethe's house, Schiller's statue, and Danica's famous Ariadne. It was very lovely, but I should have enjoyed it more if I'd known the story better. I didn't like to ask, as everyone knew it, or pretended they did. I wish Joe would tell me all about it. I ought to have read more, for I find I don't know anything, and it mortifies me. Now comes the serious part, for it happened here, and Fred is just gone. He has been so kind and jolly that we all got quite fond of him. I never thought of anything but a traveling friendship, till the serenade night. Since then, I've begun to feel that the moonlight walks, balcony talks, and daily adventures were something more to him than fun. I haven't flirted, Mother, truly, but remembered what you said to me, and have done my very best. I can't help it if people like me. I don't try to make them, and it worries me if I don't care for them, though Joe says I haven't got any heart. Now I know Mother will shake her head, and the girls say, "Oh, the mercenary little wretch," but I've made up my mind, and if Fred asks me, I shall accept him, though I'm not madly in love. I like him, and we get on comfortably together. He is handsome, young, clever enough, and very rich, ever so much richer than the Lawrences. I don't think his family would object, and I should be very happy, for they are all kind, well-bred, generous people, and they like me. Fred, as the eldest twin, will have the estate, I suppose, and such a splendid one it is, a city house in a fashionable street, not so showy as our big houses, but twice as comfortable, and full of solid luxury, such as English people believe in. I like it, for it's genuine. I've seen the plate, the family jewels, the old servants, and pictures of the country place, with its park, great house, lovely grounds, and fine horses. Oh, it would be all I should ask, and I'd rather have it than any title such as girls snap up so readily and find nothing behind. I may be mercenary, but I hate poverty and don't mean to bear it a minute longer than I can help. One of us must marry well. Meg didn't, Joe won't, Beth can't yet, so I shall, and make everything okay all round. I wouldn't marry a man I hated or despised. You may be sure of that, and though Fred is not my model hero, he does very well, and in time I should get fond enough of him, if he was very fond of me, and let me do just as I liked. So I've been turning the matter over in my mind the last week, for it was impossible to help seeing that Fred liked me. He said nothing, but little things showed it. He never goes with Flo, always gets on my side of the carriage, table, or promenade, looks sentimental when we are alone, and frowns at anyone else who ventures to speak to me. Yesterday at dinner, when an Austrian officer stared at us, and then said something to his friend, a rakish-looking baron, about ein wunderschönes Blondchen, Fred looked as fierce as a lion and cut his meat so savagely it nearly flew off his plate. He isn't one of the cool, stiff Englishmen, but is rather peppery, for he has Scotch blood in him, as one might guess from his bonny blue eyes. Well, last evening we went up to the castle about sunset, at least all of us but Fred, who was to meet us there, after going to the post-restant for letters. We had a charming time poking about the ruins, the vaults where the monster tun is, and the beautiful gardens made by the Elector long ago for his English wife. I liked the great terrace best, for the view was divine, so while the rest went to see the rooms inside, I sat there trying to sketch the gray stone lion's head on the wall, with scarlet woodbine sprays hanging round it. I felt as if I'd got into a romance, sitting there, watching the Neckar rolling through the valley, listening to the music of the Austrian band below, and waiting for my lover, like a real storybook girl. I had a feeling that something was going to happen, and I was ready for it. I didn't feel blushy or quaky, but quite cool and only a little excited. By and by I heard Fred's voice, and then he came hurrying through the great arch to find me. He looked so troubled that I forgot all about myself and asked what the matter was. He said he'd just got a letter begging him to come home, for Frank was very ill. So he was going at once, on the night train, and only had time to say goodbye. I was very sorry for him, and disappointed for myself, but only for a minute, because he said, as he shook hands, and said it in a way that I could not mistake, "I shall soon come back. You won't forget me, Amy." I didn't promise, but I looked at him, and he seemed satisfied, and there was no time for anything but messages and goodbyes, for he was off in an hour, and we all miss him very much. I know he wanted to speak, but I think, from something he once hinted, that he'd promised his father not to do anything of the sort yet a while, for he is a rash boy, and the old gentleman dreads a foreign daughter-in-law. We shall soon meet in Rome, and then, if I don't change my mind, I'll say, "Yes, thank you," when he says, "Will you please?" Of course, this is all very private, but I wished you to know what was going on. Don't be anxious about me. Remember, I am your prudent Amy, and be sure I will do nothing rashly. Send me as much advice as you like. I'll use it if I can. I wish I could see you for good talk, Marmee. Love and trust me, ever your Amy. Chapter 32. Tender Troubles. Joe, I'm anxious about Beth. Why, Mother, she seemed unusually well since the babies came. It's not her health that troubles me now, it's her spirits. I'm sure there is something on her mind, and I want you to discover what it is. What makes you think so, Mother? She sits alone a good deal, and doesn't talk to her father as much as she used. I found her crying over the babies the other day. When she sings, the songs are always sad ones, and now and then I see a look in her face that I don't understand. This isn't like Beth, and it worries me. Have you asked her about it? I have tried once or twice, but she either evaded my questions or looked so distressed that I stopped. I never force my children's confidence, and I seldom have to wait for long. Mrs. March glanced at Joe as she spoke, but the face opposite seemed quite unconscious of any secret disquietude but Beth's, and after sewing thoughtfully for a minute, Joe said, "I think she is growing up, and so begins to dream dreams and have hopes and fears and fidgets without knowing why or being able to explain them. Why, Mother, Beth's 18, but we don't realize it and treat her like a child, forgetting she's a woman. So she is. Dear heart, how fast you do grow up, returned her mother with a sigh and a smile. Can't be helped, Marmee, so you must resign yourself to all sorts of worries and let your birds hop out of the nest one by one. I promise never to hop very far, if that is any comfort to you. It's a great comfort, Joe. I always feel strong when you are at home, now Meg is gone. Beth is too feeble, and Amy too young to depend upon, but when the tug comes, you are always ready. Why, you know I don't mind hard jobs much, and there must always be one scrub in a family. Amy is splendid in fine works, and I'm not, but I feel in my element when all the carpets are to be taken up, or half the family falls sick at once. Amy is distinguishing herself abroad, but if anything is amiss at home, I'm your man. I leave Beth to your hands, then, for she will open her tender little heart to her Joe sooner than to anyone else. Be very kind, and don't let her think anyone watches or talks about her. If she would only get quite strong and cheerful again, I shouldn't have a wish in the world. Happy woman! I've got heaps. My dear, what are they? I'll settle Bethy's troubles, and then I'll tell you mine. They are not very wearing, so they'll keep. And Joe stitched away, with a wise nod, which set her mother's heart at rest about her, for the present, at least. While apparently absorbed in her own affairs, Joe watched Beth, and after many conflicting conjectures, finally settled upon one which seemed to explain the change in her. A slight incident gave Joe the clue to the mystery, she thought, and lively fancy, loving heart, did the rest. She was affecting to write busily one Saturday afternoon when she and Beth were alone together. Yet as she scribbled, she kept her eye on her sister, who seemed unusually quiet. Sitting at the window, Beth's work often dropped into her lap, and she leaned her head upon her hand in a dejected attitude, while her eyes rested on the dull autumnal landscape. Suddenly, someone passed below, whistling like an operatic blackbird, and a voice called out, "All serene, coming in tonight." Beth started, leaned forward, smiled and nodded, watched the passerby till his quick tramp died away, then said softly, as if to herself, "How strong and well and happy that dear boy looks." Said Joe, still intent upon her sister's face, for the bright color faded as quickly as it came, the smile vanished, and presently a tear lay shining on the window ledge. Beth whisked it off, and in her half-averted face read a tender sorrow that made her own eyes fill. Fearing to betray herself, she slipped away, murmuring something about needing more paper. "Mercy on me, Beth loves Lori," she said, sitting down in her own room, pale with the shock of the discovery which she believed she had just made. "I never dreamed of such a thing. What will Mother say? I wonder if her—" There Joe stopped and turned scarlet with a sudden thought. If he shouldn't love back again, how dreadful it would be. He must. I'll make him. And she shook her head threateningly at the picture of the mischievous-looking boy laughing at her from the wall. Oh, dear, we are growing up with a vengeance. Here's Meg married and a mama, Amy flourishing away at Paris, and Beth in love. I'm the only one that has sense enough to keep out of mischief. Joe thought intently for a minute with her eyes fixed on the picture. Then she smoothed out her wrinkled forehead and said, with a decided nod at the face opposite, No, thank you, sir. You're very charming, but you've no more stability than a weathercock. So, you needn't write touching notes and smile in that insinuating way, for it won't do a bit of good, and I won't have it. Then she sighed and fell into a reverie, from which she did not wake till the early twilight sent her down to take new observations, which only confirmed her suspicion. Though Lori flirted with Amy and joked with Joe, his manner to Beth had always been peculiarly kind and gentle, but so was everybody's. Therefore, no one thought of imagining that he cared more for her than for the others. Indeed, a general impression had prevailed in the family of late that our boy was getting fonder than ever of Joe, who, however, wouldn't hear a word upon the subject and scolded violently if anyone dared to suggest it. If they had known the various tender passages which had been nipped in the bud, they would have had the immense satisfaction of saying, I told you so. But Joe hated philandering and wouldn't allow it, always having a joke or a smile ready at the least sign of impending danger. When Lori first went to college, she fell in love about once a month, but the small flames were as brief as ardent, did no damage, and much amused Joe, who took great interest in the alternations of hope, despair, and resignation, which were confided to her in their weekly conferences. But there came a time when Lori ceased to worship at many shrines, hinted darkly at one all-absorbing passion, and indulged occasionally in Byronic fits of gloom. Then he avoided the tender subject altogether, wrote philosophical notes to Joe, turned studious, and gave out that he was going to dig, intending to graduate in a blaze of glory. This suited the young lady better than twilight confidences, tender pressures of the hand, and eloquent glances of the eye, for with Joe, brain developed earlier than heart, and she preferred imaginary heroes to real ones, because when tired of them, the former could be shut up in the tin kitchen till called for, and the latter were less manageable. Things were in this state when the grand discovery was made, and Joe watched Lori that night as she'd never done before. If she had not got the new idea into her head, she would have seen nothing unusual in the fact that Beth was very quiet and Lori very kind to her. But having given the rein to her lively fancy, it galloped away with her at a great pace, and common sense, being rather weakened by a long course of romance writing, did not come to the rescue. As usual, Beth lay on the sofa and Lori sat in a low chair close by, amusing her with all sorts of gossip, for she depended on her weekly spin, and he never disappointed her. But that evening, Joe fancied that Beth's eyes rested on the lively dark face beside her with peculiar pleasure, and that she listened with intense interest to an account of some exciting cricket match, though the phrases, caught off a tice, stumped off his ground, and the leg hit for three, were as intelligible to her as Sanskrit. She also fancied, having set her heart upon seeing it, that she saw a certain increase of gentleness in Lori's manner, that he dropped his voice now and then, laughed less than usual, was a little absent-minded, and settled the afghan over Beth's feet with an assiduity that was really almost tender. "Who knows? Stranger things have happened," thought Jo, as she fussed about the room. "She will make quite an angel of him, and he will make life delightfully easy and pleasant for the dear, if they only love each other. I don't see how he can help it, and I do believe he would if the rest of us were out of the way." As everyone was out of the way but herself, Jo began to feel that she ought to dispose of herself with all speed. But where should she go? And burning to lay herself upon the shrine of sisterly devotion, she sat down to settle that point. Now, the old sofa was a regular patriarch of a sofa, long, broad, well-cushioned, and low, a trifle shabby, as well it might be, for the girls had slept and sprawled on it as babies, fished over the back, rode on the arms, and had menageries under it as children, and rested tired heads, dreamed dreams, and listened to tender talk on it as young women. They all loved it, for it was a family refuge, and one corner had always been Joe's favorite lounging place. Among the many pillows that adorned the venerable couch was one, hard, round, covered with prickly horsehair, and furnished with a knobby button at each end. This repulsive pillow was her especial property, being used as a weapon of defense, a barricade, or a stern preventive of too much slumber. Lori knew this pillow well, and had cause to regard it with deep aversion, having been unmercifully pummeled with it in former days when romping was allowed, and now frequently debarred from it by the seat he most coveted next to Joe in the sofa corner. If the sausage, as he called it, stood on end, it was a sign that he might approach and repose, but if it lay flat across the sofa, woe to man, woman, or child who dared disturb it. That evening, Joe forgot to barricade her corner, and had not been in her seat 5 minutes before a massive form appeared beside her, and with both arms spread over the sofa back, both long legs stretched out before him, Lori exclaimed with a sigh of satisfaction, "Now, this is filling at the price." "No slang," snapped Joe, slamming down the pillow. But it was too late, there was no room for it, and coasting onto the floor, it disappeared in a most mysterious manner. "Come, Joe, don't be thorny. After studying himself to a skeleton all the week, a fellow deserves petting and ought to get it."
"Beth will pet you. I'm busy."
"No, she's not to be bothered with me, but you like that sort of thing, unless you've suddenly lost your taste for it. Have you? Do you hate your boy and want to fire pillows at him?"
Anything more wheedlesome than that touching appeal was seldom heard, but Joe quenched her boy by turning on him with a stern query. How many bouquets have you sent Miss Randall this week? Not one, upon my word. She's engaged. Now then. I am glad of it. That's one of your foolish extravagances, sending flowers and things to girls for whom you don't care two pins, continued Joe reprovingly. Sensible girls for whom I do care whole papers of pins won't let me send them flowers and things, so what can I do? My feelings need a vent. Mother doesn't approve of flirting even in fun, and you do flirt desperately, Teddy. I'd give anything if I could answer, so do you. As I can't, I'll merely say that I don't see any harm in that pleasant little game, if all parties understand that it's only play. Well, it does look pleasant, but I can't learn how it's done. I've tried, because one feels awkward in company not to do as everybody else is doing, but I don't seem to get on, said Joe, forgetting to play mentor. Take lessons of Amy. She is a regular talent for it. Yes, she does it very prettily and never seems to go too far. I suppose it's natural to some people to please without trying, and others to always say and do the wrong thing in the wrong place. I'm glad you can't flirt. It's really refreshing to see a sensible, straightforward girl who can be jolly and kind without making a fool of herself. Between ourselves, Joe, some of the girls I know really do go on at such a rate, I'm ashamed of them. They don't mean any harm, I'm sure, but if they knew how we fellows talked about them afterward, they'd mend their ways, I fancy. They do the same, and as their tongues are the sharpest, you fellows get the worst of it, for you are as silly as they, every bit. If you behaved properly, they would, but knowing you like their nonsense, they keep it up, and then you blame them. Much you know about it, ma'am, said Laurie in a superior tone. We don't like romps and flirts, though we may act as if we did sometimes. The pretty, modest girls are never talked about, except respectfully among gentlemen. Bless your innocent soul. If you could be in my place for a month, you'd see things that would astonish you a trifle. Upon my word, when I see one of those harum-scarum girls, I always want to say with our friend Cock Robin, out upon you, fie upon you, bold-faced jig. It was impossible to help laughing at the funny conflict between Laurie's chivalrous reluctance to speak ill of womankind and his very natural dislike of the unfeminine folly of which fashionable society showed him many samples. Joe knew that young Lawrence was regarded as a most eligible party by worldly mamas, was much smiled upon by their daughters, and flattered enough by ladies of all ages to make a coxcomb of him, so she watched him rather jealously, fearing he would be spoiled, and rejoiced more than she confessed to find that he still believed in modest girls. Returning suddenly to her admonitory tone, she said, dropping her voice, "If you must have a vent, Teddy, go and devote yourself to one of the pretty, modest girls whom you do respect, and not waste your time with the silly ones." "You really advise it?" And Laurie looked at her with an odd mixture of anxiety and merriment in his face. "Yes, I do, but you'd better wait till you are through college, on the whole, and be fitting yourself for the place meantime. You're not half good enough for, well, whoever the modest girl may be." And Joe looked a little queer likewise, for a name had almost escaped her. "That I'm not," acquiesced Laurie, with an expression of humility quite new to him, as he dropped his eyes and absently wound Joe's apron tassel round his finger. "Mercy on us, this will never do," thought Joe, adding aloud, "Go and sing to me. I'm dying for some music, and always like yours." "I'd rather stay here, thank you." "Well, you can't. There isn't room. Go and make yourself useful, since you're too big to be ornamental. I thought you hated to be tied to a woman's apron string," retorted Joe, quoting certain rebellious words of his own. "Ah, that depends on who wears the apron," and Laurie gave an audacious tweak at the tassel. "Are you going?" demanded Joe, diving for the pillow. He fled at once, and the minute it was well, up with the bonnets of Bonnie Dundee, she slipped away to return no more till the young gentleman departed in high dudgeon. Joe lay long awake that night, and was just dropping off when the sound of a stifled sob made her fly to Beth's bedside with the anxious inquiry, "What is it, dear?" "I thought you were asleep," sobbed Beth. "Is it the old pain, my precious?" "No, it's a new one, but I can bear it." And Beth tried to check her tears. "Tell me all about it, and let me cure it as I often did the other." "You can't, There is no cure. There Beth's voice gave way, and clinging to her sister, she cried so despairingly that Joe was frightened. Where is it? Shall I call Mother? No, no, don't call her. Don't tell her. I shall be better soon. Lie down here and pour my head. I'll be quiet and go to sleep. Indeed, I will. Joe obeyed, but as her hand went softly to and fro across Beth's hot forehead and wet eyelids, her heart was very full, and she longed to speak. But young as she was, Joe had learned that hearts, like flowers, cannot be rudely handled, but must open naturally. So though she believed she knew the cause of Beth's new pain, she only said, in her tenderest tone, "Does anything trouble you, dearie?" "Yes, Joe," after a long pause. "Wouldn't it comfort you to tell me what it is?" "Not now, not yet." "Then I won't ask, but remember, Bethy, that Mother and Joe are always glad to hear and help you, if they can." "I know it. I'll tell you by and by." "Is the pain better now?" "Oh, yes, much better. You are so comfortable, Joe." "Go to sleep, dear. I'll stay with you." So cheek to cheek they fell asleep, and on the morrow Beth seemed quite herself again, for at 18 neither heads nor hearts ache long, and a loving word can medicine most ills. But Joe had made up her mind, and after pondering over a project for some days, she confided it to her mother. "You asked me the other day what my wishes were. I'll tell you one of them, Marmee," she began, as they sat along together. "I want to go away somewhere this winter for a change." "Why, Joe?" And her mother looked up quickly, as if the word suggested a double meaning. With her eyes on her work, Joe answered soberly, "I want something new. I feel restless and anxious to be seeing, doing, and learning more than I am. I brood too much of my own small affairs and need stirring up, so as I can be spared this winter, I'd like to hop a little way and try my wings." "Where will you hop?" "To New York. I had a bright idea yesterday, and this is it. You know Mrs. Kirker wrote to you for some respectable young person to teach her children, and so it's rather hard to find just the thing, but I think I should suit if I tried." "My dear, go out to service in that great boarding house?" And Mrs. March looked surprised, but not displeased. "It's not exactly going out to service, for Mrs. Kirker is your friend, the kindest soul that ever lived, and would make things pleasant for me, I know. Her family is separate from the rest, and no one knows me there. Don't care if they do. It's honest work, and I'm not ashamed of it." "Nor I. But you're writing." "All the better for the change. I shall see and hear new things, get new ideas, and even if I haven't much time there, I shall bring home quantities of material for my rubbish." "I have no doubt of it. But are these your only reasons for this sudden fancy?" "No, Mother." "May I know the others?" Joe looked up and Joe looked down, then said slowly, with sudden color in her cheeks, "It may be vain and wrong to say it, but I'm afraid Laurie is getting too fond of me." "Then you don't care for him in the way it is evident he begins to care for you?" And Mrs. March looked anxious as she put the question. "Mercy, no. I love the dear boy, as I always have, and am immensely proud of him. But as for anything more, it's out of the question." "I'm glad of that, Joe." "Why, please?" "Because, dear, I don't think you suited to one another. As friends, you are very happy, and your frequent quarrels soon blow over. But I fear you would both rebel if you were mated for life. You are too much alike, and too fond of freedom, not to mention hot tempers and strong wills, to get on happily together, in a relation which needs infinite patience and forbearance, as well as love." "That's just the feeling I had, though I couldn't express it. I'm glad you think he is only beginning to care for me. It would trouble me sadly to make him unhappy, for I couldn't fall in love with the dear old fellow merely out of gratitude, could I?" "You are sure of his feelings for you?" The color deepened in Joe's cheeks as she answered, with a look of mingled pleasure, pride, and pain, which young girls wear when speaking of first lovers. "I'm afraid it is so, Mother. He hasn't said anything, but he looks a great deal. I think I'd better go away before it comes to anything." "I agree with you, and if it can be managed, you shall go." Joe looked relieved, and after a pause said, smiling, "How Mrs. Moffat would wonder at your want of management, if she knew, and how she will rejoice that Annie may still hope." "Ah, Joe, mothers may differ in their management, but the hope is the same in all, the desire to see their children happy. Meg is so, and I am content with her success. You I leave to enjoy your liberty till you tire of it, for only then will you find that there is something sweeter. Amy is my chief care now, but her good sense will help her. For Beth, I indulge no hopes except that she may be well. By the way, she seems brighter this last day or two. Have you spoken to her?" "Yes, she owned she had a trouble and promised to tell me by and by. I said no more, for I think I know it." And Joe told her little story. Mrs. March shook her head and did not take so romantic a view of the case, but looked grave and repeated her opinion that for Laurie's sake, Joe should go away for a time. "Let us say nothing about it to him till the plan is settled. Then I'll run away before he can collect his wits and be tragic. Beth must think I'm going to please myself, as I am, for I can't talk about Laurie to her. But she can pet and comfort him after I'm gone, and so cure him of this romantic notion. He's been through so many little trials of the sort, he's used to it, and will soon get over his lovelornity." Joe spoke hopefully, but could not rid herself of the foreboding fear that this little trial would be harder than the others, and that Laurie would not get over his lovelornity as easily as heretofore. The plan was talked over in a family council and agreed upon, for Mrs. Kirker gladly accepted Joe and promised to make a pleasant home for her. The teaching would render her independent, and such leisure as she got might be made profitable by writing, while the new scenes and society would be both useful and agreeable. Joe liked the prospect and was eager to be gone, for the home nest was growing too narrow for her restless nature and adventurous spirit. When all was settled, with fear and trembling, she told Laurie, but to her surprise he took it very quietly. He had been graver than usual of late, but very pleasant, and when jokingly accused of turning over a new leaf, he answered soberly, "So I am, and I mean this one shall stay turned." Joe was very much relieved that one of his virtuous fits should come on just then, and made her preparations with a lightened heart, for Beth seemed more cheerful, and hoped she was doing the best for all. "One thing I leave in your especial care," she said, the night before she left.
"You mean your papers?" asked Beth.
"No, my boy. Be very good to him, won't you?"
"Of course I will, but I can't fill your place, and he'll miss you sadly."
"It won't hurt him, so remember, I leave him in your charge to plague, pet, and keep in order."
"I'll do my best, for your sake," promised Beth, wondering why Joe looked at her so queerly.
When Laurie said goodbye, he whispered significantly,
"It won't do a bit of good, Joe. My eye is on you, so mind what you do, or I'll come and bring you home."
Chapter 33. Joe's Journal. New York, November. Dear Marmee and Beth, I'm going to write you a regular volume, for I've got heaps to tell, though I'm not a fine young lady traveling on the continent. When I lost sight of Father's dear old face, I felt a trifle blue, and might have shed a briny drop or two, if an Irish lady with four small children, all crying, more or less, hadn't diverted my mind, for I amused myself by dropping gingerbread nuts over the seat every time they opened their mouths to roar. Soon the sun came out, and taking it as a good omen, I cleared up likewise and enjoyed my journey with all my heart. Mrs. Kirker welcomed me so kindly, I felt at home at once, even in that big house full of strangers. She gave me a funny little sky parlor, all she had, but there is a stove in it and a nice table and a sunny window, so I can sit here and write whenever I like. A fine view and a church tower opposite atone for the many stairs, and I took a fancy to my den on the spot. The nursery, where I am to teach and sew, is a pleasant room next Mrs. Kirker's private parlor, and the two little girls are pretty children, rather spoiled, I fancy, but they took to me after telling them the seven bad pigs, and I've no doubt I shall make a model governess. I am to have my meals with the children, if I prefer it to the great table, and for the present I do, for I am bashful, though no one will believe it. "Now, my dear, make yourself at home," said Mrs. K. in her motherly way. I'm on the drive from morning to night, as you may suppose with such a family, but a great anxiety will be off my mind if I know the children are safe with you. My rooms are always open to you, and your own shall be as comfortable as I can make it. There are some pleasant people in the house if you feel sociable, and your evenings are always free. Come to me if anything goes wrong, and be as happy as you can. There is the tea bell. I must run and change my cap. And off she bustled, leaving me to settle myself in my new nest. As I went downstairs soon after, I saw something I liked. The flights are very long in this tall house, and as I stood waiting at the head of the third one for a little servant girl to lumber up, I saw a gentleman come along behind her, take the heavy hod of coal out of her hand, carry it all the way up, put it down at a door nearby, and walk away, saying, with a kind nod and a foreign accent,
"It goes better so. The little back is too young to have such heaviness."
Wasn't it good of him? I like such things, for his father says, trifles show character. When I mentioned it to Mrs. K. that evening, she laughed and said, "That must have been Professor Bayer. He's always doing things of that sort." Mrs. K. told me he was from Berlin, very learned and good, but poor as a church mouse, and gives lessons to support himself and two little orphan nephews, whom he is educating here, according to the wishes of his sister, who married an American. Not a very romantic story, but it interested me, and I was glad to hear that Mrs. K. lends him her parlor for some of his scholars. There is a glass door between it and the nursery, and I mean to peep at him, and then I'll tell you how he looks. He's almost 40, so it's no harm, Army. After tea and a go-to-bed romp with the little girls, I attacked the big work basket and had a quiet evening chatting with my new friend. I shall keep a journal letter and send it once a week, so good night and more tomorrow. Tuesday Eve. Had a lively time in my seminary this morning, for the children acted like Sancho, and at one time I really thought I should shake them all round. Some good angel inspired me to try gymnastics, and I kept it up till they were glad to sit down and keep still. After luncheon, the girl took them out for a walk, and I went to my needlework like little Mabel with a willing mind. I was thanking my stars that I'd learned to make nice buttonholes when the parlor door opened and shut, and someone began to hum, "Kennst du das Land?" like a big bumblebee. It was dreadfully improper, I know, but I couldn't resist the temptation, and lifting one end of the curtain before the glass door, I peeped in. Professor Bayer was there, and while he arranged his books, I took a good look at him. A regular German, rather stout, with brown hair tumbled all over his head, a bushy beard, good nose, the kindest eyes I ever saw, and a splendid big voice that does one's ears good after our sharp or slipshod American gabble. His clothes were rusty, his hands were large, and he hadn't a really handsome feature in his face, except his beautiful teeth. Yet I liked him, for he had a fine head, his linen was very nice, and he looked like a gentleman, though two buttons were off his coat and there was a patch on one shoe. He looked sober in spite of his humming, till he went to the window to turn the hyacinth bulbs toward the sun and stroke the cat, who received him like an old friend. Then he smiled, and when a tap came at the door, called out in a loud, brisk tone,
"Herein!"
I was just going to run when I caught sight of a morsel of a child carrying a big book and stopped to see what was going on.
"Me wants me, Bea," said the mite,
slamming down her book and running to meet him.
"Thou shalt have thy Bea. Come, then, and take a good hug from him, my Tina," said the professor, catching her up with a laugh and holding her so high over his head that she had to stoop her little face to kiss him.
"Now me must study my lesson," went on the funny little thing.
So he put her up at the table, opened the great dictionary she'd brought, and gave her a paper and pencil, and she scribbled away, turning a leaf now and then and passing her little fat finger down the page, as if finding a word, so soberly that I nearly betrayed myself by a laugh, while Mr. Bayer stood stroking her pretty hair with a fatherly look that made me think she must be his own, though she looked more French than German. Another knock, and the appearance of two young ladies sent me back to my work, and there I virtuously remained through all the noises and gabbling that went on next door. One of the girls kept laughing affectedly and saying,
"Now, Professor,"
in a coquettish tone, and the other pronounced her German with an accent that must have made it hard for him to keep sober. Both seemed to try his patience sorely, for more than once I heard him say emphatically,
"No, no, it is not so. You have not attended to what I say."
And once there was a loud rap, as if he struck the table with his book, followed by the despairing exclamation,
"Prut, it all goes bad this day."
Poor man, I pitied him, and when the girls were gone, took just one more peep to see if he survived it. He seemed to have thrown himself back in his chair, tired out, and sat there with his eyes shut till the clock struck two, when he jumped up, put his books in his pocket, as if ready for another lesson, and taking little Tina, who had fallen asleep on the sofa, in his arms, he carried her quietly away. I fancy he has a hard life of it. Mrs. Kirker asked me if I wouldn't go down to the 5 o'clock dinner, and feeling a little bit homesick, I thought I would, just to see what sort of people are under the same roof with me. So I made myself respectable and tried to slip in behind Mrs. Kirker, but as she is short and I'm tall, my efforts at concealment were rather a failure. She gave me a seat by her, and after my face cooled off, I plucked up courage and looked about me. The long table was full, and everyone intent on getting their dinner, the gentlemen especially, who seemed to be eating on time, for they bolted, in every sense of the word, vanishing as soon as they were done. There was the usual assortment of young men absorbed in themselves, young couples absorbed in each other, married ladies in their babies, and old gentlemen in politics. I don't think I shall care to have much to do with any of them, except one sweet-faced maiden lady, who looks as if she had something in her. Cast away at the very bottom of the table was the professor, shouting answers to the questions of a very inquisitive, deaf old gentleman on one side, and talking philosophy with a Frenchman on the other. If Amy had been here, she'd have turned her back on him forever, because, sad to relate, he had a great appetite and shoveled in his dinner in a manner which would have horrified her ladyship. I didn't mind, for I like to see folks eat with a relish, as Hannah says, and the poor man must have needed a deal of food after teaching idiots all day. As I went upstairs after dinner, two of the young men were settling their hats before the hall mirror, and I heard one say low to the other, "Who's the new party?"
"Governess, or something of that sort."
"What the deuce is she at our table for?"
"Friend of the old ladies."
"Handsome head, but no style."
"Not a bit of it. Give us a light and come on."
I felt angry at first, and then I didn't care, for a governess is as good as a clerk, and I've got sense, if I haven't style, which is more than some people have, judging from the remarks of the elegant beings who clattered away, smoking like bad chimneys. I hate ordinary people. Thursday. Yesterday was a quiet day spent in teaching, sewing, and writing in my little room, which is very cozy, with a light and fire. I picked up a few bits of news and was introduced to the professor. It seems that Tina is the child of the Frenchwoman who does the fine ironing in the laundry here. The little thing has lost her heart to Mr. Bayer and follows him about the house like a dog whenever he is at home, which delights him, as he is very fond of children, though a bachelor. Kitty and Minnie Kirker likewise regard him with affection and tell all sorts of stories about the plays he invents, the presents he brings, and the splendid tales he tells. The younger men quiz him, it seems, call him Old Fritz, Lagerbeer, Ursa Major, and make all manner of jokes on his name. But he enjoys it like a boy, Mrs. Kirker says, and takes it so good-naturedly that they all like him in spite of his foreign ways. The maiden lady is a Miss Norton, rich, cultivated, and kind. She spoke to me at dinner today, for I went to table again. It's such fun to watch people, and asked me to come and see her at her room. She has fine books and pictures, knows interesting persons, and seems friendly, so I shall make myself agreeable, for I do want to get into good society, only it isn't the same sort that Amy likes. I was in our parlor last evening when Mr. Bayer came in with some newspapers for Mrs. Kirker. She wasn't there, but Minnie, who is a little old woman, introduced me very prettily.
"This is Mama's friend, Miss March." "Yes, and she's jolly, and we like her lots," added Kitty, who was an enfant terrible.
We both bowed, and then we laughed, for the prim introduction and the blunt addition were rather a comical contrast.
"Ah, yes, I hear these naughty ones go to vex you, Miss March. If so again, call it me and I come," he said, with a threatening frown that delighted the little wretches.
I promised I would, and he departed. But it seems as if I was doomed to see a good deal of him, for today, as I passed his door on my way out, by accident I knocked against it with my umbrella. It flew open, and there he stood in his dressing gown, with a big blue sock on one hand and a darning needle in the other. He didn't seem at all ashamed of it, for when I explained and hurried on, he waved his hand, sock and all, saying in his loud, cheerful way,
"You have a fine day to make your walk. Bon voyage, mademoiselle."
I laughed all the way downstairs, but it was a little pathetic, also to think of the poor man having to mend his own clothes. The German gentleman embroider, I know, but darning hose is another thing, and not so pretty. Saturday. Nothing has happened to write about except a call on Miss Norton, who has a room full of pretty things and who was very charming, for she showed me all her treasures and asked me if I would sometimes go with her to lectures and concerts as her escort, if I enjoyed them. She put it as a favor, but I'm sure Mrs. Kircher has told her about us, and she does it out of kindness to me. I'm as proud as Lucifer, but such favors from such people don't burden me, and I accept it gratefully. When I got back to the nursery, there was such an uproar in the parlor that I looked in, and there was Mr. Bayer, down on his hands and knees with Tina on his back, Kitty leading him with a jump rope, and Minnie feeding two small boys with seed cakes as they roared and ramped in cages built of chairs.
"We are playing nargery," explained Kitty.
"This is mein Effelund,"
added Tina, holding on by the professor's hair.
"Mama always allows us to do what we like Saturday afternoon when Franz and Emil come, doesn't she, Mr. Bayer?"
said Minnie. The Effelund sat up, looking as much in earnest as any of them, and said soberly to me,
"I give you my word it is so. If we make too large a noise, you shall say hush to us, and we go more softly."
I promised to do so, but left the door open and enjoyed the fun as much as they did, for more glorious frolic I never witnessed. They played tag and soldiers, danced and sang, and when it began to grow dark, they all piled onto the sofa about the professor, while he told charming fairy stories of the storks on the chimney tops and the little coblods who ride the snowflakes as they fall. I wish Americans were as simple and natural as Germans, don't you? I'm so fond of writing I should go spinning on forever, if motives of economy didn't stop me, for though I've used thin paper and written fine, I tremble to think of the stamps this long letter will need. Pray forward Amy's as soon as you can spare them. My small news will sound very flat after her splendors, but you will like them, I know. Is Teddy studying so hard that he can't find time to write to his friends? Take good care of him for me, Beth, and tell me all about the babies, and give heaps of love to everyone. From your faithful Joe. P.S. On reading over my letter, it strikes me as rather Bayery, but I am always interested in odd people, and I really had nothing else to write about. Bless you. December. My precious Betsy, as this is to be a scribble-scrabble letter, I direct it to you, for it may amuse you and give you some idea of my goings-on, for though quiet, they are rather amusing, for which, oh, be joyful. After what Amy would call Herculaneum efforts in the way of mental and moral agriculture, my young ideas began to shoot and my little twigs to bend as I could wish. They are not so interesting to me as Tina and the boys, but I do my duty by them, and they are fond of me. Franz and Emil are jolly little lads, quite after my own heart, for the mixture of German and American spirit in them produces a constant state of effervescence. Saturday afternoons are riotous times, whether spent in the house or out, for on pleasant days they all go to walk, like a seminary, with the professor and myself to keep order, and then such fun! We are very good friends now, and I've begun to take lessons. I really couldn't help it, and it all came about in such a droll way that I must tell you. To begin at the beginning, Mrs. Kircher called to me one day as I passed Mr. Bayer's room, where she was rummaging. "Did you ever see such a den, my dear? Just come and help me put these books to rights, for I've turned everything upside down, trying to discover what he has done with the 6 new handkerchiefs I gave him not long ago." I went in, and while we worked, I looked about me, for it was a den, to be sure. Books and papers everywhere, a broken meerschaum, and an old flute over the mantelpiece, as if done with, a ragged bird without any tail chirped on one window seat, and a box of white mice adorned the other. Half-finished boats and bits of string lay among the manuscripts. Dirty little boots stood drying before the fire, and traces of the dearly beloved boys, for whom he makes a slave of himself, were to be seen all over the room. After a grand rummage, three of the missing articles were found, one over the birdcage, one covered with ink, and a third burned brown, having been used as a holder. "Such a man," laughed good-natured Mrs. K, as she put the relics in the rag bag. "I suppose the others are torn up to rig ships, bandage cut fingers, or make kite tails. It's dreadful, but I can't scold him. He's so absent-minded and good-natured, he lets those boys ride over him roughshod. I agreed to do his washing and mending, but he forgets to give out his things, and I forget to look them over, so he comes to a sad pass sometimes." "Let me mend them," said I. "I don't mind it, and he needn't know. I'd like to. He's so kind to me about bringing my letters and lending books." So I have got his things in order, and knit heels into two pairs of the socks, for they were boggled out of shape with his queer darns. Nothing was said, and I hoped he wouldn't find it out, but one day last week he caught me at it. Hearing the lessons he gives to others has interested and amused me so much that I took a fancy to learn, for Tina runs in and out, leaving the door open, and I can hear. I had been sitting near this door, finishing off the last sock, and trying to understand what he said to a new scholar, who was as stupid as I am. The girl had gone, and I thought he had also, it was so still, and I was busily gabbling over a verb, and rocking to and fro in a most absurd way, when a little crow made me look up, and there was Mr. Bayer, looking and laughing quietly, while he made signs to Tina not to betray him.
"So," he said, as I stopped and stared like a goose, "you peep at me, I peep at you, and this is not bad, but see, I am not pleasanting when I say, 'Have you a wish for German?'"
"Yes, but you are too busy. I am too stupid to learn," I blundered out, as red as a peony.
"Prut, we will make the time and we fail not to find the sense. At evening I shall give a little lesson with much gladness, for look you, Miss Marsh, I have this debt to pay."
And he pointed to my work.
"Yes, they say to one another, these so kind ladies, 'He is a stupid old fellow. He will not see what we do. He will never observe that his sock heels go not in holes any more. He will think his buttons grow out new when they fall, and believe that strings make themselves.' Ah, but I have an eye, and I see much. I have a heart, and I feel thanks for this. Come, a little lesson then and now, or no more good fairy works for me and mine."
Of course, I couldn't say anything after that, and as it really is a splendid opportunity, I made the bargain and we began. I took four lessons, and then I stuck fast in a grammatical bog. The professor was very patient with me, but it must have been torment to him, and now and then he'd look at me with such an expression of mild despair that it was a toss-up with me whether to laugh or cry. I tried both ways, and when it came to a sniff or utter mortification and woe, he just threw the grammar on the floor and marched out of the room. I felt myself disgraced and deserted forever, but didn't blame him a particle, and was scrambling my papers together, meaning to rush upstairs and shake myself hard, when in he came, as brisk and beaming as if I'd covered myself in glory.
"Now we shall try a new way. You and I will read this pleasant little Märchen together, and dig no more in that dry book that goes in the corner for making us trouble."
He spoke so kindly, and opened Hans Andersen's fairy tale so invitingly before me, that I was more ashamed than ever, and went at my lesson in a neck-or-nothing style that seemed to amuse him immensely. I forgot my bashfulness and pegged away, no other word will express it, with all my might, tumbling over long words, pronouncing according to inspiration of the minute, and doing my very best. When I finished reading my first page and stopped for breath, he clapped his hands and cried out in his hearty way,
"Das ist gut. Now we go well. My turn. I do him in German, give me your ear."
And away he went, rumbling out the words with his strong voice and a relish which was good to see as well as hear. Fortunately, the story was the Constant Tin Soldier, which is droll, you know, so I could laugh, and I did, though I didn't understand half he read, for I couldn't help it. He was so earnest, I so excited, and the whole thing so comical. After that, we got on better, and now I read my lessons pretty well, for this way of studying suits me, and I can see that the grammar gets tucked into the tales and poetry as one gives pills and jelly. I like it very much, and he doesn't seem tired of it yet, which is very good of him, isn't it? I mean to give him something on Christmas, for I dare not offer money. Tell me something nice, Marmy. I'm glad Lori seems so happy and busy that he has given up smoking and lets his hair grow. You see, Beth manages him better than I did. I'm not jealous, dear. Do your best, only don't make a saint of him. I'm afraid I couldn't like him without a spice of human naughtiness. Read him bits of my letters. I haven't time to write much, and that will do just as well. Thank heaven Beth continues so comfortable. January. A happy new year to you all, my dearest family, which of course includes Mr. L. and a young man by the name of Teddy. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed your Christmas bundle, for I didn't get it till night and have given up hoping. Your letter came in the morning, but you said nothing about a parcel, meaning it for a surprise, so I was disappointed, for I'd had a kind of feeling that you wouldn't forget me. I felt a little low in my mind as I sat up in my room after tea, and when the big, muddy, battered-looking bundle was brought to me, I just hugged it and pranced. It was so homey and refreshing that I sat down on the floor and read and looked and ate and laughed and cried in my usual absurd way. The things were just what I wanted, and all the better for being made instead of bought. Beth's new ink bib was capital, and Hannah's box of hard gingerbread will be a treasure. I'll be sure and wear the nice flannels you sent, Marmy, and read carefully the books Father has marked. Thank you all heaps and heaps. Speaking of books reminds me that I'm getting rich in that line, for on New Year's Day, Mr. Bayer gave me a fine Shakespeare. It is one he values much, and I've often admired it, set up in the place of honor with his German Bible, Plato, Homer, and Milton. So you may imagine how I felt when he brought it down, without its cover, and showed me my own name in it, from my friend Friedrich Bayer.
You say often you wish a library. Here I give you one, for between these lids,
he meant covers,
is many books in one. Read him well, and he will help you much, for the study of character in this book will help you to read it in the world and paint it with your pen.
I thanked him as well as I could, and talk now about my library, as if I had 100 books. I never knew how much there was in Shakespeare before, but then I never had a Bayer to explain it to me. Now, don't laugh at his horrid name. It isn't pronounced either bear or beer, as people will say it, but something between the two, as only Germans can give it. I'm glad you both like what I tell you about him, and hope you will know him some day. Mother would admire his warm heart, father his wise head. I admire both, and feel rich in my new friend Friedrich Bayer. Not having much money, or knowing what he'd like, I got several little things and put them about the room, where he would find them unexpectedly. They were useful, pretty, or funny. A new standish on his table, a little vase for his flower, he always has one, or a bit of green in a glass, to keep him fresh, he says, and a holder for his blower, so that he needn't burn up what Amy calls mouchoirs. I made it like those Beth invented, a big butterfly with a fat body and black and yellow wings, worsted feelers and bead eyes. It took his fancy immensely, and he put it on his mantelpiece as an article of virtue. So it was rather a failure after all. Poor as he is, he didn't forget a servant or a child in the house, and not a soul here, from the French laundry woman to Miss Norton, forgot him. I was so glad of that. They got up a masquerade and had a gay time New Year's Eve. I didn't mean to go down, having no dress, but at the last minute Mrs. Kirke remembered some old brocades, and Miss Norton lent me lace and feathers. So I dressed up as Mrs. Malaprop and sailed in with a mask on. No one knew me, for I disguised my voice, and no one dreamed of the silent, haughty Miss March, for they think I'm very stiff and cool, most of them, and so I am to whippersnappers. Could dance and dress and burst out into a nice arrangement of epitaphs, like an allegory on the banks of the Nile. I enjoyed it very much, and when we unmasked, it was fun to see them stare at me. I heard one of the young men tell another that he knew I'd been an actress. In fact, he thought he remembered seeing me at one of the minor theaters. Meg will relish that joke. Mr. Bayer was Nick Bottom, and Tina was Titania, a perfect little fairy in his arms. To see them dance was quite a landscape, to use a Teddyism. I had a very happy New Year after all, and when I thought it over in my room, I felt as if I was getting on a little, in spite of my many failures, for I'm cheerful all the time now, work with a will, and take more interest in other people than I used to, which is satisfactory. Bless you all. Ever your loving, Joe. Chapter 34. A Friend. Though very happy in the social atmosphere about her, and very busy with the daily work that earned her bread and made it sweeter for the effort, Jo still found time for literary labors. The purpose which now took possession of her was a natural one to a poor and ambitious girl, but the means she took to gain her end were not the best. She saw that money conferred power, therefore she resolved to have, not to be used for herself alone, but for those whom she loved more than life. The dream of filling home with comforts, giving Beth everything she wanted, from strawberries in winter to an organ in her bedroom, going abroad herself and always having more than enough so that she might indulge in the luxury of charity, had been for years Joe's most cherished castle in the air. The prize story experience had seemed to open a way which might, after long traveling and much uphill work, lead to this delightful chateau en Espagne. But the novel disaster quenched her courage for a time, for public opinion is a giant, which has frightened stouter-hearted jacks on bigger beanstalks than hers. Like that immortal hero, she reposed a while after the first attempt, which resulted in a tumble and the least lovely of the giant's treasures, if I remember rightly. But the up-again-and-take-another spirit was as strong in Joe as in Jack, so she scrambled up on the shady side this time and got more booty, but nearly left behind her what was far more precious than the money bags. She took to writing sensation stories, for in those dark ages, even all perfect America read rubbish. She told no one, but concocted a thrilling tale and boldly carried it herself to Mr. Dashwood, editor of the weekly Volcano. She had never read Sartor Resartus, but she had a womanly instinct that clothes possess an influence more powerful over many than the worth of character or the magic of manners. So she dressed herself in her best, and trying to persuade herself that she was neither excited nor nervous, bravely climbed two pairs of dark and dirty stairs to find herself in a disorderly room, a cloud of cigar smoke, and the presence of three gentlemen, sitting with their heels rather higher than their hats, which articles of dress none of them took the trouble to remove on her appearance. Somewhat daunted by this reception, Jo hesitated on the threshold, murmuring in much embarrassment, "Excuse me, I was looking for the weekly Volcano office. I wish to see Mr. Dashwood." Down went the highest pair of heels, up rose the smokiest gentleman, and carefully cherishing his cigar between his fingers, he advanced with a nod and a countenance expressive of nothing but sleep. Feeling that she must get through the matter somehow, Jo produced her manuscript, and, blushing redder and redder with each sentence, blundered out fragments of the little speech carefully prepared for the occasion. "A friend of mine desired me to offer a story, just as an experiment. Would like your opinion. Be glad to write more if this suits." While she blushed and blundered, Mr. Dashwood had taken the manuscript and was turning over the leaves with a pair of rather dirty fingers and casting critical glances up and down the neat pages.
"Not a first attempt, I take it,"
observing that the pages were numbered, covered only on one side, and not tied up with a ribbon, sure sign of a novice. "No, sir. She has had some experience and got a prize for a tale in the Blarney Stone Banner."
"Oh, did she?"
And Mr. Dashwood gave Jo a quick look, which seemed to take note of everything she had on, from the bow in her bonnet to the buttons on her boots.
"Well, you can leave it if you like. We've more of this sort of thing on hand than we know what to do with at present, but I'll run my eye over it and give you an answer next week."
Now, Jo did not like to leave it, for Mr. Dashwood didn't suit her at all, but under the circumstances there was nothing for her to do but bow and walk away, looking particularly tall and dignified, as she was apt to do when nettled or abashed. Just then she was both, for it was perfectly evident from the knowing glances exchanged among the gentlemen that her little fiction of "my friend" was considered a good joke, and a laugh, produced by some inaudible remark of the editor as he closed the door, completed her discomfiture. Half resolving never to return, she went home and worked off her irritation by stitching pinafores vigorously, and in an hour or two was cool enough to laugh over the scene and long for next week. When she went again, Mr. Dashwood was alone, whereat she rejoiced. Mr. Dashwood was much wider awake than before, which was agreeable, and Mr. Dashwood was not too deeply absorbed in a cigar to remember his manners, so the second interview was much more comfortable than the first.
"We'll take this.
Editors never say I.
If you don't object to a few alterations. It's too long, but omitting the passages I've marked will make it just the right length,"
he said in a businesslike tone. Jo hardly knew her own MS again, so crumpled and underscored were its pages and paragraphs, but feeling as a tender parent might on being asked to cut off her baby's legs in order that it might fit into a new cradle, she looked at the marked passages and was surprised to find that all the moral reflections, which she had carefully put in as ballast for much romance, had been stricken out. "But, sir, I thought every story should have some sort of a moral, so I took care to have a few of my sinners repent." Mr. Dashwood's editorial gravity relaxed into a smile, for Jo had forgotten her friend and spoke as only an author could.
"People want to be amused, not preached at, you know. Morals don't sell nowadays."
Which was not quite a correct statement, by the way. "You think it would do with these alterations, then?"
"Yes, it's a new plot and pretty well worked up. Language good, and so on," was Mr. Dashwood's affable reply.
What compensation, began Jo, not exactly knowing how to express herself.
"Oh, yes, well, we give from 25 to 30 for things of this sort. Pay when it comes out," returned Mr. Dashwood, as if that point had escaped him. Such trifles do escape the editorial mind, it is said.
"Very well, you can have it," said Jo, handing back the story with a satisfied air, for after the $1 a column work, even 25 seemed good pay.
"Shall I tell my friend you will take another if she has one better than this?" asked Jo, unconscious of her little slip of the tongue and emboldened by her success. "Well, we'll look at it. Can't promise to take it. Tell her to make it short and spicy and never mind the moral. What name would your friend like to put on it?" in a careless tone.
"None at all, if you please. She doesn't wish her name to appear and has no nom de plume," said Jo, blushing in spite of herself.
"Just as she likes, of course. The tale will be out next week. Will you call for the money, or shall I send it?"
asked Mr. Dashwood, who felt a natural desire to know who his new contributor might be.
"I'll call. Good morning, sir."
As she departed, Mr. Dashwood put up his feet with a graceful remark.
"Poor and proud, as usual, but she'll do."
Following Mr. Dashwood's directions and making Mrs. Northbury her model, Jo rashly took a plunge into the frothy sea of sensational literature, but thanks to the life preserver thrown her by a friend, she came up again, not much the worse for her ducking. Like most young scribblers, she went abroad for her characters and scenery, and banditti, counts, gypsies, nuns, and duchesses appeared upon her stage and played their parts with as much accuracy and spirit as could be expected. Her readers were not particular about such trifles as grammar, punctuation, and probability, and Mr. Dashwood graciously permitted her to fill his columns at the lowest prices, not thinking it necessary to tell her that the real cause of his hospitality was the fact that one of his hacks, on being offered higher wages, had basely left him in the lurch. She soon became interested in her work, for her emaciated purse grew stout, and the little hoard she was making to take Beth to the mountains next summer grew slowly but surely as the weeks passed. One thing disturbed her satisfaction, and that was that she did not tell them at home. She had a feeling that father and mother would not approve, and preferred to have her own way first, and beg pardon afterward. It was easy to keep her secret, for no name appeared with her stories. Mr. Dashwood had, of course, found it out very soon, but promised to be dumb, and for wonder, kept his word. She thought it would do her no harm, for she sincerely meant to write nothing of which she would be ashamed, and quieted all pricks of conscience by anticipations of the happy minute when she should show her earnings and laugh over her well-kept secret. But Mr. Dashwood rejected any but thrilling tales, and as thrills could not be produced except by harrowing up the souls of the readers, history and romance, land and sea, science and art, police records and lunatic asylums had to be ransacked for the purpose. Jo soon found that her innocent experiences had given her but few glimpses of the tragic world which underlies society, so regarding it in a business light, she set about supplying her deficiencies with characteristic energy. Eager to find material for stories, and bent on making them original in plot, if not masterly in execution, she searched newspapers for accidents, incidents, and crimes. She excited the suspicions of public librarians by asking for works on poisons. She studied faces in the street and characters, good, bad, and indifferent, all about her. She delved in the dust of ancient times for facts or fictions so old that they were as good as new, and introduced herself to folly, sin, and misery, as well as her limited opportunities allowed. She thought she was prospering finely, but unconsciously, she was beginning to desecrate some of the womanliest attributes of a woman's character. She was living in bad society, and imaginary though it was, its influence affected her, for she was feeding heart and fancy on dangerous and unsubstantial food, and was fast brushing the innocent bloom from her nature by a premature acquaintance with a darker side of life, which comes soon enough to all of us. She was beginning to feel, rather than see this, for much describing of other people's passions and feelings set her to studying and speculating about her own, a morbid amusement in which healthy young minds do not voluntarily indulge. Wrongdoing always brings its own punishment, and when Jo most needed hers, she got it. I don't know whether the study of Shakespeare helped her to read character, or the natural instinct of a woman for what was honest, brave, and strong, but while endowing her imaginary heroes with every perfection under the sun, Jo was discovering a live hero who interested her in spite of many human imperfections. Mr. Bayer, in one of their conversations, had advised her to study simple, true, and lovely characters wherever she found them, as good training for a writer. Jo took him at his word, for she coolly turned round and studied him, a proceeding which would have much surprised him had he known it, for the worthy professor was very humble in his own conceit. Why everybody liked him was what puzzled Jo at first. He was neither rich nor great, young nor handsome, in no respect what is called fascinating, imposing, or brilliant, and yet he was as attractive as a genial fire, and people seemed to gather about him as naturally as about a warm hearth. He was poor, yet always appeared to be giving something away, a stranger, yet everyone was his friend, no longer young, but as happy-hearted as a boy. Plain and peculiar, yet his face looked beautiful to many, and his oddities were freely forgiven for his sake. Jo often watched him, trying to discover the charm, and at last decided that it was benevolence which worked the miracle. If he had any sorrow, it sat with its head under its wing, and he turned only his sunny side to the world. There were lines upon his forehead, but time seemed to have touched him gently, remembering how kind he was to others. The pleasant curves about his mouth were the memorials of many friendly words and cheery laughs. His eyes were never cold or hard, and his big hand had a warm, strong grasp that was more expressive than words. His very clothes seemed to partake of the hospitable nature of the wearer. They looked as if they were at ease and liked to make him comfortable. His capacious waistcoat was suggestive of a large heart underneath. His rusty coat had a social air, and the baggy pockets plainly proved that little hands often went in empty and came out full. His very boots were benevolent, and his collars never stiff and raspy like other people's. "That's it," said Jo to herself, when she at length discovered that genuine goodwill toward one's fellow men could beautify and dignify even a stout German teacher who shoveled in his dinner, darned his own socks, and was burdened with the name of Bayer. Jo valued goodness highly, but she also possessed a most feminine respect for intellect, and a little discovery which she made about the professor added much to her regard for him. He never spoke of himself, and no one ever knew that in his native city he had been a man much honored and esteemed for learning and integrity, till a countryman came to see him. He never spoke of himself, and in a conversation with Miss Norton divulged the pleasing fact. From her, Jo learned it, and liked it all the better because Mr. Bayer